official Adam Sank Show merchandise at adamsank.com. T-shirts, tank tops, mugs, masks, just about everything you can think of emblazoned with the Adam Sank Show logo. Go to adamsank.com to order your merch today. Thank you.
Warning. The program you're about to hear contains highly offensive and indecent material.
This is the Adam Sank Show.
If it's in my hand, I'm going to suck it.
Powered by DNR Studios. And now...
the one, the only, Adam Sank!
Bottom.
Hello, I'm a bottom. Welcome to the Adam Sank Show. We are not live, but this is a brand new episode of it's a brand new episode of sorts of the Adam Sank Show. If you're listening live at 11 a.m. Eastern on Saturday, December 18th, it's almost Christmas time, guys. 2021 at dnrstudios.com in the DNR Cast app, the only place to hear this podcast live and throughout the week that it first airs. Leave us your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to this show. Email me at adam@adamsank.com. Call us on the Ass Hotline. Leave us a voicemail, perhaps a holiday greeting. Wish us a happy Hanukkah, a Merry Christmas, a happy Kwanzaa, a happy New Year, anything you want. 804-TALK-ASS is the number for that. Like the Adam Sank Show Facebook page, download my comedy albums, get your ass merchandise. They make a great Christmas gift, Joanne.
I think that you're right.
At adamsank.com. And please get vaccinated if you haven't already done so. Today, as you just heard, Joanne Phelan is back, guest co-hosting with me. We just can't get rid of you, Joanne.
I know. Well, I heard this was about chicks.
This special is about chicks.
I love chicks.
Joanne really loves chicks more than anyone in this room right now. The show is called, it's a best of ass, and it's called Chicks We Love. These are some of our, not all of our, but some of our favorite female guests in the history of the Adam Sank Show. We'll be looking back at some of the highlights of those. But first, it is my great privilege to welcome back the man who makes this show happen through his own blood, sweat, and tears, the queen of fuckery, Ms. J.B. Bursey. Yay!
Why would you say it? Because it's true, y'all. It's true.
She sweats. Because last week's show that we recorded had a lot of technical challenges, and it's going to take JB a long time to fix those challenges in post. But that's why he gets the big money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll work on it either tomorrow. Most likely I'm going to work on it tomorrow.
Well, in the magical world of podcasting, it's already done.
It's already done.
And they've already heard it.
Yes.
We're talking about last week's episode with Cynthia Lee Fontaine, which was really memorable.
I remember that.
It was fun. We had Cynthia. We had Romaine. We had Matthew Camp. It was
crazy.
That show had something for everyone. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so before we begin to look back at some of our favorite female guests, Joanne, I was wondering, mm-hmm. as a lesbian,
yes.
and a comedian,
that's a me.
Who are the women who most have inspired you in your life?
Like as a lesbian comedians or as in my
just women,
life?
Women in general, like that you saw on stage or in a movie or on TV or heard on the radio and just became an inspiration for you. Someone you looked up to, someone you admire.
Well, I mean, always was and will forever be a big fan of RBG.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Mm-hmm. Oh, love that woman. Love that woman.
Yeah. Oh. Quite an inspiration.
Yes. She's always been one. But as far as inspiration and comedy and, basically comedy, I'm going with Carol Burnett.
Oh, such great answer.
Beautiful, beautiful woman.
I'm going to say the funniest person who ever lived. How about that?
I will go with that. I will back you up on that.
Just, I don't think there's anyone who makes me laugh or has made me laugh the way Carol Burnett has.
I know. Those shows.
Brilliant.
You could watch them forever.
And, like, comedy wasn't even the only thing she was great at. Like, she's a great mm-hmm. actress. She's an amazing singer.
Yes.
She can belt her face mm-hmm. off. She can dance.
Yep.
Just really an amazing woman. So great, great answer.
Thank you.
That's going to be my answer from now on.
Great.
Let's go to the tape, as they say. Mm-hmm. The first clip we're going to run right now actually features Joanne Phelan.
Oh, my.
Along with comedian Irene Bremis. I've had the two of you on the show together a number of times.
I absolutely love her. She makes me proud to be a lesbian.
Even though she's a straight woman.
Yes.
I'll buy that. This is going back 3 years. To November 2018, almost exactly 3 years ago, episode 70. Tarek Daniels was my guest co-host that day. I love Tarek, and you know, he's become a school teacher.
Over the past couple of years. Very impressive.
Yes. This was Joanne and Irene's third appearance. The whole episode is great. I really recommend that you go back and listen to all of episode 70. But in this segment, we mostly talk about marriage and relationships. Joanne and Irene are both married. I, at the time, was single. But we, at the very beginning of the interview, within seconds, we start talking about the clitoris.
Yes. Which, I mean, why wouldn't you?
It's just what happens when we have you two on the show. So take a listen to this clip from episode 70, November 3rd, 2018.
Is it clitoris or clitoris? I've never really known.
I say clitoris.
I just say clit.
When I say
clit mouth, if you're being a real cunt.
Clit mouth.
You're being a clit mouth. That's an insult? I feel like that's offensive to
women. Well, it depends.
Clitty, clitty, bang, bang.
Clitty, clitty, bang, bang. We like it. We take the show to a whole other level.
Have you seen a lesbian porn with that title, Joel?
No, I am now going to go out and make one.
Clitty, clitty, bang, bang. Why has no one ever thought of that?
I call it a lady button.
Oh my God, that's so sweet.
Of course, you guys know the scat.
Of course, you haven't seen mine. Mine is no lady, sweetie, or butt.
You guys know the scat version of that is called Shitty Shitty Gangbang.
Oh, wow. I like it.
It's not pretty.
It's a double feature.
You both have something unusual about you to be on this show. First of all, as I said, three-time champions, but also you're both married.
Oh, but not many to of each my other.
Not to each other yet.
Wow. I mean, I think about her all the time.
Me
I
too.
Download the image of her.
I think
her
about her lady button.
Because it's painful, right? It's no lady, sweetie. Trust me. Like I said.
That ain't no lady. That's Irene's bush.
Yeah.
Nice.
So
oh,
yeah, but honestly, her. Most of the guests, because it's most of the guests are gay men, which is my mistake. We don't have enough estrogen on this show. But most of my guests are unmarried. How long has each of you been married? How have you been married, Joanne?
We actually just celebrated our 4-year wedding anniversary last month.
Congratulations.
So, thank you.
And how long have you been together or total?
47 years. No. a very long time. Very long time. We wanted to go with the whole let's make it legal when it's actually legal.
So what's a long time? 10 years?
I think about 10 years. Yeah.
Wow. Irene, how long have you and your husband been married?
Oh, God. We've been married for about, let me see, it's been 8 years, but it's in dog years. So
because like you like to do it like doggy style.
Oh, we love doggy style. There's nothing. I love it. It's a small, he's Irish, so it's great. It feels like a butt plug. It's fantastic.
Your husband has a small penis?
It's sort of like a pacifier when I have insomnia. It's so great.
But is it uncut? Is it small?
No, it's not small. I'm just kidding. It's good. Pretty, he's 6'6". He's pretty,
he's got a
substantial amount of, you know, meat.
Of tree.
Of tree, sweetie. Yeah, we'll
big
the callback with tree. Yeah.
Irish tree.
Yeah.
Wait,
Irish
so he's got a big Irish dick, and it is circumcised.
It's circumcised, yeah. I mean, I like circumcised, although...
Me too.
I really do.
Well, you're Jewish.
Uncircumcised is kind of, you know, it feels like a hug, though.
Are you cut, Tark?
Yeah.
I am, unfortunately. I wish
Thank
I wasn't.
God.
I love uncut, though.
We'll discuss this another time.
Yeah,
I know it's controversial.
Also out of the loop.
Yeah.
We have to include Joanne in this. I'm sorry.
Joanne, are you uncut?
Uncut, uncensored.
So my question for you both, because you both, I mean, that's an accomplishment to me. As someone whose longest relationship is with his dog.
Lady.
Amazing.
I don't know how one stays in a relationship, let alone married, for a decade. What's your secret? What would you tell people who are trying to find the one or keep the one?
Okay.
Stop trying.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't.
You've seen The Handmaid's Tale? Well, I'm the handy maid's tale. A lot of hand jobs, a lot of lube. It's a very arduous road.
Oh, I wish the sound effects worked. I keep trying to hit like jerking off sound effects, ejaculation sound effects.
Yeah.
None of
it's
working.
Just gonna have to do it manually.
I think expectations have to be. You know, there has to be a level of gravitational pull of reality. You can't have like these crazy expectations that I think a lot of people today. And listen, everybody likes to be treated like a queen, but today with social media, when people are hooking up, they have these grandiose expectations right away. And I think with marriage, you just develop a friendship, right? Am I right?
Absolutely.
And you accept each other. There's a lot of acceptance. There's a lot of, you know,
it's not like
compromising.
You're not on all the time. Like,
you're not on all the time.
I have a question.
My husband doesn't think I'm funny at all.
Do you marry your best friend? Is that actually the case, or is that just
right? Do you consider your spouse your best friend?
Absolutely not.
Joanne says yes. Irene says no. Joanne, yours is.
Yeah. Yes,
That's sweet.
By definition, yes, because I spend the most time with her, I guess. I love my dog, too.
But I guess I was in a relationship for 4 years. That was my longest one ever. This was going back decades. And I found, and this was a problem, that there were, if I had something I needed to talk to someone about, I wouldn't want to talk to him. I'd want to talk to one of my friends.
Right.
Okay.
Do you guys, if like, who's the person you go to? Is it always your spouse?
I wouldn't say always, because it depends on what it is. Like, when I want to talk about something with comedy.
She doesn't give a shit.
She doesn't give a shit. No. no, I mean, like, when it's something that I just don't think that she is experienced in, you know, frustrations of comedy. I mean, she'll listen to me if I talk about being frustrated and stuff like that. But, you know, I like to talk to other comedians sometimes about that. But overall, I think I do tend to go to her to talk about most things.
Irene, you said your husband's not your best friend.
You know what? He's not my best friend. And, you know, thank God, because I expect a lot more out of my best fucking friend. It's that simple, okay?
Expect a bigger
fuck
dick.
Fuck you, Steve. I'm just kidding. No, really, I like to keep roles. You know, I've always loved when people, you know, for me, like when somebody says, my mom's my best friend. Really, bitch? Get a best friend for the love of God, okay?
Or your daughter.
She's your mom, your daughter. You know, right. I get it. You're close to this person. But for me, you know, a best friend is somebody that you could really tell who you've cheated on your husband with. And that you could never, I'm just kidding. You never go to your husband with that information.
Yes. No.
I do have best friends. And there's, we all know this, right? Don't we have different levels of best friends?
Yeah.
I don't like to say best friends.
It gets kind of weird with best friends too, right?
My best friends tend to shift. Like I'll have one or two people that I'm super close to for 5 to 10 years.
Then
our lives change. It's not that we don't like each other anymore, but someone gets a boyfriend or someone moves or, you know, things shift.
Do you ever have jealous best friends, Adam? Because I'd be so jealous if you were somebody else's best friend.
Really?
I'd be very territorial with you. I'd have to piss on you.
Well, you'd have to talk to my best friends. I think their general feeling is that I'm a huge pain in the ass and you can have me.
Is Scott listening live?
Scott never listens to the podcast. He only listens if he's on it.
That's your best friend, though, right?
Ryan and Scott have become my closest friends over the past couple years. They don't even feel like friends anymore. They both feel like younger. Well, Scott feels like a younger brother, and Ryan feels like my son. Honestly, it's the most like father-son relationship I've ever had in my life, and that includes me and my own father. He's 20 years younger than me, and we, in some ways, we're very much alike, and in some ways, like, I really feel that age difference because he's just such a kid, and when we met, he needed a lot of guidance, shall we say, and I hope that I've given it to
him.
Who
better? You're so awesome. I love you.
Yes.
Who better?
And knowledgeable. You're very
knowledgeable. You're smart. You're funny.
This is why I have
gorgeous.
Him back on the show so much.
Yeah.
He's doing good.
You have a really
nice butt.
He
probably wants to secretly fuck you. You know that, right?
Who, Ryan?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I don't think so. When we first met, we went
when
on a...
Harry met Harry, sweetie. Everybody knows that.
Well, he's Harry. I'm smooth.
Nice.
When we first met, we went on a date, and I immediately felt like this doesn't feel right. It's kind of like one of those stories Tark and I were just talking about where someone's much older. It just felt creepy to me. He's the same age as my nephews. And I think we both felt from the get-go like we're better off as close friends. But let me ask you guys this, going back to the marriage thing, because so many gay relationships, many if not most, gay male relationships are open. And you're just fucking people, doing three ways, going off on your own, getting blown in the steam room. Can either of you imagine being
so
in that
jealous.
Kind of marriage?
I hate you.
Are you jealous of that?
I fucking am, because a fact is that sex just dwindles when you're married, you know, unless, of course, that clay scene on Ghost is on. Then I have to whip out the lube.
If I have to
jerk off Steve one more time to Ghost.
He's the one that likes it.
Unchained Melody.
How slow do you have to go through that Unchained Melody song?
Good question, Joanne. Where's that bell when you need it?
That's a very slow song.
Best of Ass.
Chicks we love.
This next guest I want to revisit is the actress known as Shakina. She's just got one name. Her real name is Shakina Nafak. And this is just a little bit later that year, December 1st, 2018, episode 74. Chris Harder was the co-host. Did you ever watch the show Difficult People, Joanne?
No, I never. I don't even know
very funny show that Shakina played a nightmare waitress. I love having her on the show because she's one of those people who has no pretense and no filter. She just puts it out there.
Yes, I totally got that from listening.
Yeah, and she basically just tells us the story in this interview of her coming to terms with her gender. It was kind of fascinating and funny and enlightening. And I don't know, I think she's a really interesting person. So take a listen to Shakina back on December 1st, 2018.
Tell us your entire story. Leave nothing out. Start at the beginning.
Da, 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 da.
We have 4 hours.
Yeah, so let's see. I grew up in Southern California, and I was like a radical gay teenager before there were radical gay teenagers. Mm-hmm. So it was like part of the queer youth movement. Mm-hmm. And then I like discovered what transgender was when I got to college and changed my name and became a performance artist. And then discovered this dance form called Buto that's like very like transcendental and spiritual and aggressive, and realized that like before I changed my body, I wanted to like change my soul, or at least like confirm my soul. And so I spent like a decade just trying to dance into the female form that I wanted to be in the world. Wow. And then eventually I was like, all right, time to cut the dick off, and had to like crowdfund that. And so I started this like campaign called Kickstart Her, and I had just kind of moved to New York, and it was like trying to start a career as a director. Hadn't been an actor forever and ever.
I'm sorry. So how old were you when you decided to actually move ahead with confirmation surgery?
I was 32 when I decided that I was going to start the crowdfunding.
And you'd been living as a woman since college?
No, I came out like as trans in like the turn of the century, and like was like presenting female as much as possible without like changing my body. But then I had like, there was a couple things that happened. There was like, I had sort of a rape experience. I had 9/11 happened, and then I found Buto, and all those things together sort of made me like really question my priorities. Mm. And I had like a lot of fear and also a lot of sense that like the old models that we had have come to rely on were just no longer serving, but both me personally and then like as a country and as like a globe. And so I kind of retreated back into being a dude, but was still like focused on cultivating my feminist and feminine sense of self. But like I had a chin strap and I was like really like tough looking, and I drove a truck. But like all my friends knew that like
so interesting.
I was identifying as a trans woman, but I like looked like I could beat you up. Sure. And all the guys wanted to fuck me, and I was like, sorry, it's like false advertising. Because I wasn't about to like, you know, bring it. Like I just, it was like if.
But you were having sex with men during this time.
Yeah, on occasion. Mm-hmm. But once it would like tend toward relationship and like the truth of who I was would come out, it was like, you know, I was.
You feel like you were an imposter in a way? Like
totally.
They thought they were with a man, but you were a woman.
Yeah. It was like really this weird situation. It was like I was like sort of too male for the straight men and too female for the gay men. And
sure.
Yeah, so I didn't really know where I fit.
And go ahead, Chris.
Oh, I was going to say, but does that also play into, you know, you talk about these outdated modes of what it means, you know, to be, I think, to be queer, to be masculine
totally.
Or feminine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was fully aware that these, like, systems could not hold. Mm-hmm. But I also, it's like, I learned because I was out there on the front lines from a very young age in terms of like social disruption that you can try to fuck with those old systems and break shit down. But if you are not also healing the way those systems have traumatized you, you're not actually going to achieve like progress in your own evolution. So you can like work toward, you know, social evolution, social change. But if you don't address your own trauma and healing, then you're kind of stuck at whatever place you
sure.
experience that trauma. And for me, as a trans person growing up in like the height of the AIDS epidemic and like coming into my own sense of sexual self in the 80s and 90s, like my whole life was trauma, regardless of like, you know, physical experiences like gay bashing or rape, just the actual existence of like being in a society that continuously sends you messages that you're not worthy of love, that like that your identity equals death, you know, things like that. So,
excuse me, a horrible noise just came out of me.
That was awesome.
That was like an internal burp.
Yeah, it was like a demon with the headphones on. Yeah.
Sorry, Shakina. That was disgusting.
I love it. I love bodily noises.
I fell in love with you. Not just from Difficult People, but also when I heard an interview you did with the LGBT Q&A podcast.
Oh, yeah. That was so much fun.
It was really like one of the best interviews I've ever heard because you, and I say this as a compliment, you have no boundaries. You have no, nothing's private. Like you put it out there.
Yeah.
And one of the things I heard you say on that show is that when you first had your surgery, everyone who came over to your house, you showed them your vagina.
Oh, totally. Like tours. Yeah. Famous people and strangers. Yeah. It was because it was like, well, first of all, like about 450 people like contributed to the fund to raise the money for it. So I felt like it was
sometimes you get stickers. Sometimes you get
a t-shirt.
Yeah. Exactly. So like the high level donors. No, I mean, I felt like, so here's my thing is I'm all about like demystification, you know, because I think that a lot of the fear that folks bring, you know, to questions of trans identity and trans acceptance come from just not knowing. Mm-hmm. And especially in our, like, patriarchal society, like, most destructive men are in some way propelled by a castration anxiety, you know?
Yes.
And it's like, so to be a person who's like, actually, I like was really enthusiastic about turning my genitals inside out. Doesn't make sense to people and terrifies them. And so I was just like, yeah, I think it's important. Like, and you know, I talk about it and not everyone does. It's like, I think the transgender like respectability politics are like, let's not make it about bodies. Let's not focus on surgery.
Right. You're not supposed to ask. You're not supposed to tell. And I think your approach, I mean, I don't want to tell any trans person how to tell his or her story, but I think your approach is the right one. You know, we have Jay, my friend Jay is on the show all the time. He's a trans man. And Jay just says, like, I have a vagina. Mm-hmm. He's like, I've always had a vagina. I like my vagina. They don't make good penises. And I think that that's helpful.
Yeah.
To people in understanding not only who he is, but that it's not about what's between your legs. That's not what makes you your gender.
Totally. Well, I wouldn't say it's the right one for me. And I think it's important that there are people like me and Jay out there who are willing to have those conversations so cis people can have some more understanding. But I also absolutely honor and respect trans folks who just don't want that to be a part of the conversation. Sure. And I think, you know, cis folks do have to learn that it's not okay for them to lead with those questions. But if trans folks like myself present themselves to say, now's the moment, I'm here to answer your questions, then it's like, there's a vehicle for that.
Right.
I think so.
Here's my vagina.
Yeah, let's go.
Rock.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Like, I just look at my family who are like well-intentioned, liberal, cisgender, straight people. You know, they want to get it. They want to be accepting. And they just don't get it because their information isn't out there. And so they'll say like, oh, but your friend Jay is still a woman then because she has a vagina. And I'm like, no. Like, and I just feel like if we were to talk about these things more, there are people who want to get it.
Right.
But just don't.
Well, I think we have to have a balanced conversation between like the facts experiences of physical bodies and like all the things that transition entails and just all the multitude of forms that bodies can come in and go through. But also we have to have on the other side of that conversation, like a really thorough discussion of social construction and the way our thoughts and attitudes have been shaped by like countless years of, you know, patriarchal oppression. And, and that's not just in gender, that's in like race and class and physical ability and all those things. So, I think in order to have a comprehensive understanding of trans identity or any identity that's coming from a marginalized perspective, you have to be able to ask the sort of the obvious questions and you have to be willing to ask the less obvious, more complicated, you know, questions about, you know, political realities and social
constructs. And to listen too, right? I feel like sometimes I have to remind myself too, like you just have to accept sometimes that if that is what the person says, then respect that answer, you know? And it's hard. It's hard to remember that, especially when you consider yourself a well-intentioned person to be like, oh, actually, I can just shut up right now and listen.
Yeah, you know? And it's also like a powerful thing to say is like, whoa, I don't understand that. Mm-hmm. And that's okay.
Right.
Like, you don't have to. Sure. So the understanding will come. The more you listen, pay attention, keep yourself open. So it's not like the first time mm-hmm. you know, that you hear something, you're going to be like, I got it. Right. You know,
it's an evolution. I mean, I feel like I understand more about trans people than I did 6 months ago.
Sure.
And 6 months ago, I understood more than I did 5 years before. Like, it's the conversation is new. Even though being trans is as old as time, the conversation is new for most people. And mm-hmm. so it's like we have to feel our way.
Best of Ass.
Chicks we love.
This next interview, Joanne, it may be my favorite guest interview of all time. This is when we had Julie Halston on the show.
Bitsy.
Most people know her as Bitsy Von Muffling from Sex and the City, but she's so much more than that. At the time that we had her on the show, actually, she was appearing on Broadway in Tootsie, the musical, which was hilarious and in which she was hilarious. So we talked about that. But first, I really wanted her to talk about her breakout role, which was in Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. This was a huge off-Broadway show in the 80s. It ran for 5 years. Charles Bush, another dear friend of mine and a great friend of the show, it was his show. And he basically discovered Julie and gave her her professional theater career, which is what we talked about in this interview, episode 108 from August 31st, 2019.
Julie, I want to go back to the 80s.
Yes.
When I first became aware of you.
Yes.
I told Charles Bush when he was on the show that when I was growing up in Summit, New Jersey, the only Jew in Summit, New Jersey, we'd go to the local synagogue and they had twofers in the lobby on the table that, for different off-Broadway shows. And one of them was Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. And I would go, what is this? And why is this sitting out in the lobby of a synagogue?
In Summit, New Jersey.
How did you and Charles first meet?
Well, it's a wacky kind of story. There's a guy that I went to college with. He was Bobby Cohen when I knew him. Then he got married and he changed his name to his husband's name, Bobby Ducharme. But he knew Charles Bush from childhood. He knew me from college. And he thought that we should meet. And I was like, well, I actually don't need another gay man in my life.
Right.
I need to get laid, actually. You know what I mean?
That's good.
Dang. But he was like, no, I really think you guys would really get on. Anyway, cut to a number of years later, particularly in like the early 80s when we first became aware of gay pneumonia. Remember, it was called gay pneumonia.
Mm-hmm. And gay cancer.
And gay cancer and GRID. Mm-hmm. It wasn't called AIDS then. Bobby was living in San Francisco and he was like, you should come to San Francisco and do a fundraiser because we know people who are dying in San Francisco Memorial Hospital and we don't know why they're, except that they're gay. We don't know what's going on. I didn't know. I was working on Wall Street, wanting to be an actress, kind of auditioning on the side, working on Wall Street because I needed money. I happened to go out to see Bobby. I did do this weird little fundraiser where I did like a one-woman show. I don't even remember what it was called. I think it was called like An Evening with Julie Halston. Charles was in the audience because he happened to be doing his one-man show. It was at the Valencia Rose, which was a mortuary. It used to be a mortuary. Well, believe me, my doing my show was a mortuary.
Oh, no, it didn't go
well. No, it was really bad. But he
must have seen something in you.
He did. I was quite stylish. I had a sort of Vidal Sassoon cut with a white jumpsuit and
fabulous.
A gash of red lips. But I didn't really think much of Charles. He didn't really think of much of me. And by the way, at that time, who was also, I think, appearing at the Valencia Rose was Leah Delaria, like
love
who
her.
Would sort of say, I adore
She's
her,
great.
Sort of sing, but then just say, are you a dyke? Fuck you. You know, I mean, it was like, is that the act?
Right.
Is that the act? Well, it was, I guess. Anyway, we were all there.
I didn't know that she had started that early. She must have been a kid.
Yes, I think she was. And she was sort of, even then, true to who she was.
Yeah.
Anyway, Charles and I didn't really, we were very wary of each other. He got back to New York. He was doing his one-man show. He needed an audience. He literally invited you know, literally like pigeons on the street, anyone he knew. And it just so happened that even though I had a terrible act, I knew a lot of people. So he invited me to his act, and I kept bringing people. And he was like, I'll comp you in, I'll comp you in. I kept bringing people to his act, and he was like, well, she is popular. You know, she might be untalented, but she's popular.
You were a draw.
I was a draw on a certain level.
Yeah.
And I fell mad for his act. I loved it. It was called Alone with a Cast of Thousands. And he would just put a hat on and be a woman, or put a scarf on and
be... Was this at Duplex?
No, it was at a place that doesn't even exist anymore. It was called the Shondal Theater. And you literally went there, like, imperiling your own life. Literally, rats would be, like, under your feet.
Oh,
it was
wow.
scary. It was somewhere in Chelsea. Oh. I think it was in Chelsea, actually. Mm-hmm. The Shondal. It was scary.
Oy, what a Shonda.
But it was a Shonda, the Shondal. I don't know what it is now, but it really needed to be destroyed. But anyway, he ended up writing this little skit. It was a skit called Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. Mm. No one would be his co-star. Even his own sister turned him down.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, he really couldn't get anyone to be his co-star. Alola Paschalinski from the wonderful Charles Ludlam Company, the Ridiculous Theater, she did it one weekend and was like, I'm out. Done.
Why was there such resistance to it? Because it was so strange?
No, it was because... he was doing it on the Lower East Side, which was a very dangerous area at that point. There was no bathroom. Lola Paschalinski was a legend in the off-Broadway world. This was off-Broadway. We might as well have been in Summit, New Jersey.
Right. There wouldn't have been any rats.
Yeah, exactly. And we could go shopping.
Yeah.
You know.
Short Hills Mall.
You literally walked into these places on the Lower East Side, and like you would... stepping on syringes, crack vials, crack pipes. It was scary.
So you said, sign me up.
I was like, sign me up. Great. I did. And he was like, well, can you act? I mean, you know what I mean? He saw my act, didn't like it.
And you could act. You had been trained.
I went to Hofstra University, and I was a performance major. But, you know, they didn't know what to do with me either. I'm not joking. Everyone was just like, she's got something. But
we're not sure
but
what it
what?
Is. How to harness
it. You know, I wanted to be Hedda Gabler, and they were like, what? You speak in Comac language, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, I went to his apartment. Ken Elliott was our director. They sort of auditioned me, but didn't, you know. It was sort of like, let's just read it. Well, it just kept getting worse and worse. And Ken was, I heard him in the kitchen. He was like, Charles, she's terrible. What are we going to do? And he was like, well, she told me she played Nina in The Seagull at Hofstra, and which I did in a lab. But anyway, long story short, I met the company. They loved me. I loved them. I still didn't quite get the style, the sort of heightened style. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, guys, I know I stink in rehearsal, but you put a wig on me and put me in front of a crowd of gay men, and I am going to glow. And let me tell you, I walked out on that stage, and magic happened.
Alive.
It really was a crazy alchemy. I don't know if it was the wig, you know, because the costume was like my own clothes.
Yeah.
But was it the lashes? Was it the wig? What was it? But it was this strange alchemy. You know, performers kick in.
Well, and I think it's something you probably have in common with drag queens.
Yes. I was just thinking about that.
You know, a drag queen one-on-one can be a big bore.
Yeah.
But a drag queen, when she's in full drag
on
and walks
stage.
Out into a nightclub, like, is
it's transformative.
Magical.
Yeah, it's magical. It's alchemy. It's transformative. That's what happened. And the audience went cuckoo for my character.
Best of Ass.
Chicks we love.
All right. At this point, Joanne, I thought we would take a little break from the clips.
Oh, thank goodness.
And it's time for a breather.
Yes.
All these bitches talking.
Oh, no,
come on. No, I thought we would do a female-centric list, a gyno-centric list, if you will.
Oh, I love my gyno. Would be so excited.
It's a reminder that it's time to see him or her.
Oh, her.
I'm assuming it's a her.
Oh, it's a her.
Stupid of me. this is a list of the 12 best-selling artists of all time. Now, this list was created, it was compiled, I should say, in February of 2021. So it's, I imagine it's fairly current because we're talking about album sales in the hundreds of millions. And I was wondering why they did top 12 instead of top 10. And I think it's because they really wanted to include 12 and 11. And you'll know why when you hear who it is. So the number 12 best-selling female artist of all time, Nicki Minaj. Not my favorite person at the moment because she persuaded millions of people not to get vaccinated by passing along a ridiculous urban legend about her cousin's friend and his testicles. But Nicki Minaj, you got to hand it to her. She has sold 100 million albums. Her number one singles, well, she has one number one single, Trolls, featuring, JB, you're going to have to help me, 6IX9. Is that how you say it?
69.
Oh, it's 69 is how you pronounce this person?
Yeah, I guess. I don't pay attention much to her. Like, she made a song, and then she got arrested, and then I feel like she just became famous just for doing dumb shit. And I'm not here for the fuckery.
Shade.
I'm not arguing with you. Her best-selling album was called Pink Friday. She's had three best-selling albums, Pink Friday, Roman Reloaded, which went to number one on the Billboard 200, and the Pink Print and Queen, which both reached number two in the U.S. So there you go. I mean, for someone who's a fairly recent artist, like she's only been around for a decade, just about, for her to be one of the top 12 best-selling female artists of all time is pretty remarkable.
That,
Number 11 is Beyonce. I thought she'd be higher.
Seriously.
118 million albums sold. Her number one singles include Crazy in Love, Baby Boy, Check on It, Irreplaceable, Single Ladies, and Perfect Duet. I love all her songs.
Yeah, you gotta love her.
She also was the fastest selling album, hers was the fastest selling album ever on iTunes.
That's not surprising.
By the way, before we continue with the list, can you guys guess without looking who number one is going to be?
Dolly Parton.
What do you say?
We actually don't have that list that you have. Oh. So,
yeah. I just wanted to get that
one. This is all of all time, correct?
Yes.
Is it Whitney?
You're guessing Whitney and you're guessing Dolly.
Yeah, but I don't know that I really
will. Let's continue and see how correct you are. Number 10, Adele. Also, you know, only famous since 2008, 2009. 120 million albums sold. Her number one singles include Rolling in the Deep, Someone Like You, Set Fire to the Rain, Hello, and Easy on Me. Her best-selling album is 21. She's had a remarkable career, and she's still only in her early 30s. Right. Well, another person who came up very recently, you know, around the same time as Adele, Lady Gaga. Lady Gaga.
Lady Gaga.
Sold 124 million albums. She's got a number of number one songs. Yeah. Just Dance, Poker Face, Born This Way, Shallow, Rain on Me. Her best-selling album is The Fame Monster. She's also an Oscar winner. She's really done the thing.
She sure has.
The Fame was certified triple platinum. She's a big deal. Number eight, beating out Gaga, which surprised me. It was Katy Perry.
Oh, what? Okay, what?
143 million albums. Number one singles are I Kissed a Girl, California Girls, Teenage Dream, Firework, Last Friday Night, E.T., Part of Me, Roar, Dark Horse. She got a fuckload of number ones.
Yeah.
Her best-selling album is One of the Boys. Number seven, Barbra Streisand.
Oh,
hello, gorgeous. I thought she'd be higher on this list. She was a mega artist in the 60s and 70s. She has sold 150 million albums. Her number one singles are The Way We Were, Evergreen, You Don't Bring Me Flowers, No More Tears, and I Am a Woman in Love, and I'd Do Anything. I love that album. Barbara's done it all. Number six, I Am So Famous, Everyone Loves Me.
Frenchy-French.
Celine Dion.
Okay.
My bad French-Canadian accent.
I was going to sound
him. Celine has sold 200 million albums. Number one singles are The Power of Love, Because You Love Me, My Heart Will Go On, and I'm Your Angel. The best song she sings, for my money, is It's All Coming Back to Me Now.
Oh,
which Meatloaf also has a version of. Fabulous song. So, yes, she is the sixth top best-selling female artist in the world, but she is Canada's best-selling recording artist of all time.
Well, Canada is known for their best-selling.
Listen, know. Canada is known for a lot. Canada has imported some of the best comedy in the world.
That's true. That's true. They do have...
And hockey.
Okay. I'll go along
I'm told.
That. That sounds reasonable.
And Celine Dion.
Yeah.
No, there are a number of great artists that come out of Canada. Number five is Whitney Houston.
Oh, there you go.
So sorry, JB. She's not number one. She's number five.
Well, at least she made the list.
She absolutely, deservedly so. She sold 200 million albums. Her number one singles are Saving All My Love for You, How Will I Know, The Greatest Love of All, I Want to Dance with Somebody, Didn't We Almost Have It All, So Emotional, Where Do Broken Hearts Go, I'm Your Baby Tonight, All the Man That I Need, I Will Always Love You, and Exhale. And her best-selling album? Does anyone know?
Whitney?
Turn your mic on.
Wasn't the one with Exhale?
It was the soundtrack to The Bodyguard.
Okay.
Which is also the best-selling movie soundtrack of all time. Oh. I think until Titanic came along.
Right.
Number four is someone that we've talked about a lot on this show because everyone loves her except for me, Mariah Carey.
No, I'm going to go along with I don't love her either.
She does nothing for me.
Nope, not a thing.
But she sold 200 million as well. I'm not sure how she beats Whitney. Maybe it's...
I think she's kind of trashy.
Sorry. Joanne, so controversial. Her number one singles include Vision of Love, Love Takes Time, Someday. I'm not going to read all these. I don't give a shit. Number three is someone who I really don't like, who everybody loves, Taylor Swift.
Oh, I am so with you.
I also don't like her.
Just don't get the Taylor Swift. I admire that she has written so many hit songs at such a young age, but I never go, oh, I can't wait to hear the new Taylor Swift song.
No, I do not either.
Not my thing. She has sold, she's the first singer to have the best-selling album of the year 5 times.
Yeah.
None of us seem to care. Okay, number two is, by the way, she's also sold 200 million. There must be some way that because she's had the same number as Whitney and Mariah. They all have 200 million. There must be some factor that they're not telling us about to
rank
these.
She's younger.
Number two is someone I do love and who I do think is really cool, Rihanna.
Oh.
250 million albums. Okay. Number one singles are SOS, Umbrella, Ella. Take a Bow, Disturbia, Rude Boy, Only Girl, What's My Name, S&M, We Found Love, which is my favorite song by her.
Oh, that is a good
song. We found love in a hopeless place.
That's a good song.
Diamonds, another great song that Sia wrote, or Sia. And Work. She's earned 9 Grammys, 13 American Music Awards, 12 Billboard Music Awards, and 6 Guinness World Records. She's also just gorgeous and cool.
Yes.
She's so fucking cool.
I concur.
I wish I could be as cool as Rihanna. And number one, you said her name a few minutes ago, Madonna.
Madonna is the
number one best-selling female artist in history. 300 million albums sold. Number one singles. Here we go. Like a Virgin, Crazy for You, Live to Tell, Papa Don't Preach, Open Your Heart, Who's That Girl, Like a Prayer, Vogue, Justify My Love, This Used to Be My Playground, Take a Bow, and Music. Take a Bow might be my favorite song. It's so lovely.
I can't think of how does it go?
Take a bow. The night is ever. This masquerade is
okay. Yes.
Closer.
That's nice. That's a good one.
It's so beautiful. That with Babyface, she did that song. Her best-selling album is her greatest hits album, The Immaculate Collection.
Okay.
She has been certified by the Guinness World Record Book as a best-selling female artist. Most successful solo artist ever. Solo artist ever, male or female, of the Billboard Hot 100 charts. And holds the record for the most number one songs by a female singer in Australia, Canada, Italy, Spain, the UK, and the United States.
Jeez.
Long live Queen Madonna.
How come Dolly Parton didn't make it?
Yeah, I'm surprised. And all I can say is that country music fans don't buy as many albums as pop and rock fans. I mean, those were all real pop singers.
True.
All right, time to get back to the best of chicks we love. And this next one is one of my favorite comedians, as well as one of my favorite people in the world, Michelle Buteau.
Oh, she is awesome. She's very inspirational.
You've done shows with her,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Oh, God. So hilarious. Just on and off stage. Just such a bubbly, major persona.
She's a light. Mm-hmm. She's a light in the world. She's been on the show a couple times. This was her second appearance. It was during the shutdown, so I was doing the podcast from home. She was on the phone. Not the greatest technical setup, but it was still great because it was her. Episode 137. You know, we reminisced about the days when I had my show at therapy. Joanne, did I know you then?
I think vaguely, but...
You never performed at my therapy show, did you?
I don't think that I did.
Were you there after Brad Locally took it over?
I think I was.
How fun for you.
Yeah.
Well, in this interview, you know, Michelle was one of my favorite headliners at therapy, and my audience there just loved her. And so we started talking about that, and she said some really sweet things about me in this clip, and it's entirely narcissistic for me to play it again, but I'm a narcissist. So anyway, when we did the interview, she had just appeared on the Tales of the City reboot on Netflix, which was so sensational, and she was great on the show. So we talked about Tales of the City, we talked about my therapy show, we talked about me. Take a listen. Episode 137, May 2nd, 2020. Michelle, I was watching the other night, I was watching a set on YouTube that you did in 2016. And I had to look up where the space was because I've never seen this space. It's called the Green Space at WNYC and WQXR.
Oh my God, yes.
Do you remember that show?
Vaguely. I've done so much stuff at WNYC and I'm usually tipsy because they do have wine in the green room.
Oh, nice. It's a beautiful set. The crowd was kind of like a little bit cunty, but I realized watching you what I learned from you as a comedian when I was just starting out, and that is that you are always present on stage, always, and
Yes. You
don't seem to give a shit about the jokes all that much. Like it doesn't seem to matter to you whether you get the jokes out or not, or whether you tell all the jokes that you had planned to tell. You're focusing on the room and on the experience that everyone's having. And that was so important to me because, you know, when you start out, you think like, oh my God, I have 5 jokes and they're going to take 12 minutes and I need to do every joke and I need to tell them just this way. And when I started watching you back in the day, I was like, this bitch doesn't care about any of that. She's just like having fun. Did that come naturally to you, or did someone teach you that?
I think both. I mean, why am I going to do this really hard thing where everyone's like, you're never going to make any money unless it's fun? And, you know, when I took classes at the American Comedy Institute with Steve Rosenfeld back in the day, hey, shout out, the number one rule of comedy was to have fun. And so I was like, yeah, that's how I feel in life as well. Why would you do anything if it's hard, whether it's a relationship or a job or, like, you know, even self-care? It's like, it should be fun. And so, you know, comedy is much like life. You can have a plan, but, you know, it's not for the universe. It's like, whatever, bitch, with that plan, they're going to throw you a bunch of lemons and you better have fun making that lemonade. And so, you know, your show at therapy back in the day was such a great education for me because it was really the first gay room that I played that I didn't have to bring people to perform.
Right.
And so it wasn't all like 6 coworkers who spent $40 on 2 glasses of wine and were just like very excited. No, and I call your show Showtime at the Apollo with gay people, like with gay men. Aww. All the time because I'm just like, if they don't like you, they're going to start talking. They might even boo. They're going to order a quesadilla. They're going to go do some coke. They're going to get a Cosmo. No, you know, you have to, like, own the room in the moment, and then maybe you have some jokes in your back pocket.
It was a very special, magical time, that show, because, like you said, there was no cover charge. And so
Yeah. We
got just the most random crowd. A lot of people who came because they wanted to watch Desperate Housewives, which we would show on the big screen at 9. And then at 10, it was like, okay, time for stand-up. And you're right. Like, that room taught me how to be a comedian because if they didn't like a joke, like, they let you know it. they were not polite.
You could have been so bitchy to the audience and to some performers and really just like go off, you know, for people that don't respect the stage or a community. But you were so professional. And I think what you taught me now that we're going down this road is professionalism. You know, whether it's a gig in Jersey for a bunch of straight people or a crazy rowdy Sunday night or a free show for a bunch of gay boys, it's like, be fucking professional. Look your best, do your best, keep it moving. But I feel like also you always get your point across even if you don't say it. So I'm like, ooh, Adam in my day. Adam the day. So that's what I really appreciate about you.
Thank you, baby. Well, of all of the people that were in that sort of circle at the time, you by far have been the most successful. And I feel like most of it's happened in the last like 5 years. Like I feel like you finally got your due. And suddenly it was like every time I turned on the TV, there was Michelle Buteau. So I have to ask you first and foremost about Tales of the City, which has always been such a special thing for me ever since I read Armistead Maupin's books, you know, when I first came out of the closet. Like, did you know when you got involved with that project how iconic and how important that was for like the LGBTQ community?
You know, I remember back in the day, not on PBS, but I think it was like the Showtime situation. I remember just like this edgy show that I wasn't allowed to watch. And then I slowly but surely learned about it as I would go to San Francisco and do comedy, you know, stuff like that. But then when I auditioned for it and started, you know, I like to do a lot of research. And I think a lot of people, comedians and actors and, like, personalities that get auditions don't do enough research. If you're going to spend the time, you know, to sort of showcase your talents in front of somebody, do the work. It's a job. At least 8 hours in a day, or at least spread those hours out. So I researched everything I could about Armistead, like all the things, and I watched the show, whatever was available on YouTube. And I'm like,
the original series.
What it was. This is what it is. And so I don't know if it helped or hurt my situation because, you know, the stakes were even higher. Because I'm like, this is going to be a beautiful story, and I want to do it justice. And so I was really honored. I had an audition in front of Laura Linney, and, you know, I don't really get nervous anymore. I get excited, but I will say I was shaky hands McGee. I was like, Laura,
yeah, that's big.
Yeah, and Alan Poole. I mean,
Was it a good experience for you? Did you enjoy filming it?
To be a part of that project.
It was a fun production.
Oh my God, it was one of the, hands down, one of the best productions, real talk, because it was a queer writer's room, and all the directors were queer as well, and I've never been on a set with so many trans people. It was beautiful. It was like little unicorns walking around. I'm like, are you serious? So, you know, when people throw around that hashtag or phrase, diversity matters, I really feel like this production, you know, definitely honored that. It was so damn fun. And I actually had, like, not a sex scene, but I had a topless scene that they ended up cutting, which I was really disappointed about because it was my first topless scene. And I'm always just, like, normalizing titties. And then you really have to be careful what you put out, you know, because it's all fruition.
I'm kind of
They're like, oh, you have a topless scene tomorrow in bed, you guys are just spooning. I'm like, I just had steak tartare yesterday. You couldn't give me a heads up? So
I feel cheated that we didn't get to see Michelle Buteau's titties. Like, those are famous titties. Like, they've been a part of your act for 20 years, and I think
I know it's a part of my life. I mean, let's be honest. These titties are Absurd Planet. They are my National Geographic Absurd Planet.
It would have been iconic. Michelle, in the time remaining, it's time to play everyone's favorite quiz show, Ask Me No Questions. Normally, I have a pre-recorded bumper for this, but, you know, we're very low-tech nowadays, so I'm just going to sing it. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Ask me no questions. Ask me no questions. Yeah. Okay. What part?
Beautiful.
Thank you. What part of your husband's body do you find the sexiest?
Oh, that's so hard. But I want to say, like, his lower back is, like, very strong.
Does he have one of those natural curves? I love a lower back curve.
Yes, he does. It looks like he's a surfer, but he's not.
I love a little bit of scoliosis. Okay, when was the last time you trimmed your bush?
Oh, God, before the pandemic. So let's say Black History Month is usually what I do.
So it's pretty wild.
It's wild. It's wild down there. I have to dig in there, really, to figure out where to wipe. Too much.
Best of Ass.
Chicks we love.
The last clip we're going to play today, Joanne, is by a lesbian pioneer in the world of comedy, Suzanne Westenhofer.
That is true.
Do you know her? Do you have any experience with her? Have you slept with her?
Can't say that I have done any of that. I have seen her on the streets in P-Town. That's about as much
there you go.
As I can say.
Well, as we've said several times on the show, she was the first out lesbian comedian to ever appear on TV on the Sally Jesse Raphael show. And this was the second time she was on the show. I really like Suzanne. I think she's one of the coolest, most down-to-earth people. And she's always been very supportive of me. And I just, you know, for me, her and Bob Smith will always hold a special place in the pantheon of out gay comedians.
That's nice.
So this is recently that we had her on, September 11th, 2021, episode 202. We were talking about cancel culture, if such a thing exists, and its impact on comedy. And I thought she had some really interesting things to say about that. So take a listen to Suzanne Westenhofer from September 11th, 2021. You started doing comedy at a very different time, culturally speaking.
Oh, my God.
Do you feel... I mean, you did, even before I did, and for me it's changed so much, but do you feel the pressure of what they call cancel culture on your stand-up these days? Are you watching every word that you say very carefully?
A little. Yes, I'm going to say a little because who's gotten the people who have gotten in my world, you probably feel this too. The people that have gotten like sort of sensitive and unfunny are the gay community from the 20s, from their 20s to like the 40s.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're very sensitive about everything. And it's weird because I'm like, all the things we fought for, marched for, what I put a career on the line for, you know what I mean? They now are like, oh, we shouldn't say it that way, or we shouldn't do it. Because, for example, to make a point, I did openly gay stand-up. I started in 1990 as an openly gay stand-up, openly lesbian stand-up. And I would say things like, hey, I call myself a faggot. Now they don't even want you to use the word faggot.
Right.
Or the word tranny was taught to me by my friends who were transgender because they liked it because they thought it was cute, you know, as opposed to transsexual.
Right.
They were like, oh, man, no, I'm a tranny. I'm not a transsexual. Like, they didn't like that word. And then all of a sudden that word became... not okay. And yet, if you talk to older trans folk, they remember when tranny was kind of cute.
Right.
It's like, I'm a tranny.
I mean, some of this is we're just old, right? Like, we're getting old.
I guess so. And things are changing.
And things are changing. And things are always changing. Things changed dramatically from the 50s to from the 50s to the 90s and from the 90s to the 2020s. Like, shit changes. Things that were once okay are not okay, and it's sort of our responsibility as artists to be aware of that.
To try to find out, yes, to be aware and find out.
But
and,
I do feel like with stand-up, there's something that's been lost when we have to be so careful. Because my era of stand-up in the early 2000s, it was like the more offensive you could be, the more shockingly offensive you could be, the more people thought you were funny.
Right.
And
the Andrew Dice Clay.
Well, right. I mean, that was earlier than me, but
oh, it is. Yeah.
I'm thinking of Sarah Silverman's early stuff. Remember when Sarah Silverman?
Yep.
Sarah Silverman would get on stage and she would play a character who was a terrible person.
Right.
And said terrible things. And, you know, she evolved a lot. And in some ways, I think she's a better comic now. But
you knew when you were watching Sarah Silverman that she didn't actually believe the things she was saying, that she was trying to be the most disgusting person she could be. And there was a wink and a nod.
Right.
And that's, you can't do that anymore. There's no way to do that now because everyone just takes you, everything you say literally, even though it's supposed to be a joke.
I think the, for comics, it's up to us to continue to be the court jesters, meaning I can't allow myself to any big degree to get caught up in cancel culture, and most comics shouldn't. You still have to say the things that are funny and that are your truth. In saying that, it's never been funny about rape.
Right.
Right? I mean, there are a handful of things that even the harshest male comic, you know what I mean, knows is going to be like, whoa, 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 whoa. But if you make politically correct and all that kind of stuff part of stand-up comedy, then there is no stand-up comedy, because we come from the court jester who was allowed to say the things
that
no
nobody
one
else
was
could
allowed
say.
To say right. in front of the king.
Right.
So it has to, we can't, if you change that, then now you're looking at basically canceling the idea of stand-up comedy.
Right. Suzanne, we have about 4 minutes left, but we've never gotten to play Ask Me No Questions with you because the game didn't exist the last time you were on the show. So here we go.
That doesn't sound familiar.
Ask Me No Questions.
Yeah. Here we go. What's the sexiest part of a woman's body?
Her butt.
Oh, you're a butt woman.
Yeah.
Ryan likes butts too, my co-host. He can sympathize. Who is your celebrity crush?
The first one was an actress named Susan Hayward.
Oh, yeah.
Very famous in the 40s, 50s.
Yes, she was in Valley of the Dolls.
Yes.
That's an interesting celebrity crush.
I loved her. Love, love, love.
Who would you say, like, contemporary crush?
Maybe Kristen Stewart. She's way too young. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's, because they're so much younger.
She's sexy.
Because it would feel creepy. But I'm going to say probably Kristen Stewart.
What's the first joke you ever told on stage?
I said, well, good evening. I guess I'll be the only lesbian comedian that performs tonight. And then I went, that you know of.
That's cute.
And it was, yeah. And then I said something like, I called myself the lesbian Barbie because my mom gave me all these Barbie dolls, but she never understood why there were all these chew marks on the neck.
You were like molesting your Barbies.
Right.
That's funny. I'm going to give you an
1990, dude. 1990.
Come on.
Different times.
I'm going to give you an F, Mary, Kill. Have you played this game before?
I have.
Now, we always pick three people with the same name as the guest, but I could only think of two famous Suzannes. So one of these is a Susan. Your choices are Suzanne Summers, Suzanne Vega, and Susan Sarandon. F, Mary, Kill.
Boy, and hasn't this changed? Kill, this has changed so dramatically. Kill Susan Sarandon.
Correct.
And then I guess fuck Susan. You said Suzanne Summers, right?
Yes.
And now I just forgot who the other one was.
Suzanne Vega.
The singer.
Yes.
My name is Luca.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll marry her. She seemed like she might be a good person, too.
Now, you were correct about murdering Susan Sarandon because her political views are
she lost
unacceptable.
This, yeah, she but lost her mind.
I would fuck Suzanne Vega because she's kind of a cool chick, and I would marry Suzanne Summers because she's got the Thighmaster money.
Ooh, I didn't go for money.
She has serious money.
Best of Ass.
Chicks we love.
And that brings us to the end of Best of Ass Chicks We Love.
Oh, those were wonderful clips.
We'll peel back the curtain and let the listeners know that we had to record the bumper a number of times because, Joanne, give us some of the versions that you gave us. Best of Ass.
I love chicks.
No, that's not right, Joanne. Let's try it again. Best of Ass.
I love chicks.
No, it's chicks we love, and that's still creepy. Let's try it again. That's literally how it was for 10 minutes. But eventually you got it. You nailed it. Joanne, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
These 3 weeks have been a joy. You're always welcome.
I have to go home and shave.
Your face.
Yes.
You're always welcome on the Az. JB, thank you so much. Plug yourselves one last time. Go ahead, Joanne.
Joanne Filan at everything on all things.
And that's Joanne with an E and Filan without one.
Exactly.
That's Stalker Anarchy 12, only on Instagram. Please send me dick pics. Thank you so much.
Don't send me dick pics.
Send Joanne vagina pics.
Okay.
Tune in next week to hear another brand new ass. Ryan Frostig will be back. It'll be our 2021 Christmas special with exclusive musical performances from some of our favorite people. Subscribe to this podcast at dnrstudios.com. Don't forget to order your ass merch at adamsank.com. Follow me on Twitter and Insta at Adam Sank and on TikTok at Adam Sank Official. Email me your dick pics, not your vagina pics, to adam@adamsank.com. Have a great week, bitches. Bye.